This is Icon Art Radio with Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby. The subject of today's discussion is photography. Now, photography used to be the kind of lesser cousin of fine art, of painting and sculpture and architecture. But it has definitely grown up and is definitely a dominant force in the art world today, and it has grown from a means of capturing the documentation of what's going on in society to being a very powerful art form in its own right. In fact, you see more photography, installation art, and video art today than you see actual easel painting in the galleries. So photography is very hot. When it emerged in the mid-1800s, it completely changed our view of what the artist is to do, because his role of documenting historical events was now over. And so it led to a great change in the history of art. Let's go with photography and see where we come out.
Yeah, I've been photographing all my life, and I sort of have taken it for granted in some ways, but I taught photography at Goddard College for a year, and the name of the course was sequential imagery, and the idea was to take a series of photographs and do something with the juxtaposition of the sequence, as opposed to an individual photograph. But really what comes to mind, I guess most dramatically for me, and it is always what I think of first when I think of my experience of photography, is right about the beginning of that year when I was teaching, I had the good fortune to run into someone who was trying to sell a camera in a big hurry, and all he wanted was $150, and anybody who could come up with it could have his camera. And I took one look at the camera, and it was a Zeiss Icon Contarex, which is a single lens reflex that was probably one of the best ever made. And the lens on it was a Zeiss planar at 50 millimeter 1.4 lens, a very bright lens, and it was huge. It was just beautiful, big lens from probably the most preeminent German lens company. So I bought the camera. I didn't have $150, but I ran around and found, you know, 15 people who had $10 and came back and bought the camera. And that camera, it had a very bright viewfinder. It was 100% of the visual of the field that was being shot. The camera weighed a ton and was built like a tank. But the lens was so bright and so perfect, and the image was so flat and absolutely flawless, that everything that I looked at, and I'd been shooting with my father's Leica since I was a child, and that's the camera that I had, really, was the Leica. And the old Leicas had little tiny viewfinders, and they were really horrible to look through, even though they were made by Leica. And this thing, I couldn't look at something through this camera without seeing a picture, whether it was a photograph or not. It was framing the world for me, and somehow enhancing it at the same time. And it was just magical. And I spent years just shooting everything in sight, because everything that you look at can be, you know, an image worth looking at again. Or everything you look at can be ignored because it's just the stuff that happens to be in front of you. And so for me, photography was the beginning of learning how to see.
Yeah, and appreciate things that may seem like ordinary things. I have a habit of photographing dishes in my dish drainer, or, you know, even dishes in the sink with soap suds in them or something like that, because somehow that little tiny image, when you frame it, separate it from everything else, is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of photographs are beautiful. When you were talking earlier about the history of art and photography together, I remembered hearing stories about Picasso when he first discovered or started taking pictures himself. It kind of contributed to his desire to paint in the Cubist style. He never painted directly from photographs, but what fascinated him about photography was that with different kinds of lenses, you could take a picture of something that you couldn't see with the human eye. So if you had a wide-angle lens or a telephoto lens, he would take a picture of something and it was not the same thing, not the same perspective that he would have if he were, and he couldn't do with his eye what the camera could do with these different lenses. And that just absolutely fascinated him. And also with focusing or putting things out of focus, that there was a way of altering reality that was very inspiring for him.
That's interesting too, because in a sense, the camera can teach us more about how the eye itself is altering reality, because what the eye is seeing is optically the same as what the camera sees with a 45 degree field of view lens, and yet our experience of what we see is completely different from what the camera sees. You know, if you look through a camera and turn your head around, you can see the shapes of the walls and the buildings and things all changing as the perspective of the lens changes. And yet when you stand there and look around, your brain tells you that everything stays the same and that the perspective is not changing and the walls are not bending and flexing and tilting and untilting, and you're not surrounded by trapezoids, you're surrounded by perfect rectangles. And none of that is correct. It's not there. And of course, that's part of learning how to paint, is learning how to see what is there rather than what we think is there. And then, of course, it's your choice.
The way the human eye sees it, like a photo lens sees it.
Yeah.
Because we know that the room down there is just as tall as the room here, but what we actually see is that it seems smaller down there than here. And the camera just catches that.
Right.
And you can definitely see the lines converging. And yet it's a single line of vision and a single snap of that line of that moment of that line of vision. And then in the next moment we turn our head, in the next moment we turn our head. And so we take a zillion snapshots of the information and the brain translates it into this holistic concept that we live in.
Yeah.
And so it is a very unique experience. And this is, I think, what you're talking about with what made Picasso's photos unreal to him, is that they captured a piece of this information, like either the lens that only captured a small portion of your entire field of vision, or a lens that blew it up to almost include your field of vision. And then it's just one shot and another shot. And what I think fascinated him with his art was that he could take a dozen or 50 different shots and put them all together in one painting.
Yeah, right.
And that film of Picasso painting where he just keeps reworking the same painting and changing it, moving the people around and moving the buildings around. It's a good example of that, because he really is seeing how that scene can be seen from, two dozen or five dozen, different vantage points and perspectives. And with the camera, you can't capture that, because that's not in the scene. That's in the artist.
I just remembered this little... My son went through a phase, Dane, when he was in college, he went through a phase of making pinhole cameras out of just about everything imaginable. And he had... one of the most interesting was a little tin box, like, this kind that sometimes would come in Celestial Seasonings tea. There was like a little tiny tin box with a lid. Mm-hmm. So he had this little box and he made four holes in it. And so he made like multiple images, you know, four images of whatever he was photographing of several things. And it was in a show, actually, that it, the university, when he was an art student there, where on a table there was the little box, which was the camera, and then you open it up, and inside there was a pile of the photo papers that he had made these images on of various things. And they were absolutely wonderful. I was completely enthralled by that pinhole camera, the one he made out of a detergent box and vary it with curved paper in it. And he would put the pinhole camera, one of my favorite photographs, he put the pinhole camera at the end of an alley, and it had this curved piece of paper, photo paper in it, and he then would, he left it there for a long time, and he would move himself about every minute or so mm-hmm. to another spot on the alley and sit there, and then he would move again to another spot. So when the picture came out, the alley is there with the brick buildings and everything, and then there's this ghost-like images of Dane in several places yeah. around the picture.
I'm reminded of an early film, not a still photograph, but photographs nonetheless, made by Buster Keaton, who was actually a pioneer photographer and isn't generally recognized as such. He made a film of a stage with seating for an orchestra. And then he made a frame that he put in front of the camera, which was divided up into sections. And there was a little door, in effect, for each seat in the orchestra. And so he'd rewind the film, open one door, and have his assistant, you know, crank the camera while he played an instrument in that chair. Uh-huh. And then he would rewind the film, close that little door, and open the next little door, and he'd sit in the next chair and play a different instrument. Uh-huh. And he did, I think, 16 different instruments. So there's 16 Buster Keatons all simultaneously playing different
Whoa.
Instruments in this orchestra.
Where can you see this? Is this?
I've seen it. I've run into it on the internet. Probably Googling Buster Keaton would lead to it sooner
yeah.
or later.
That's wonderful. But I love that.
It's such an incredibly, you know, inventive thing to do in the early days of movie making.
Yeah.
And that's part of, you know, part of what happens, I think, when new technology like photography comes on the scene. Not that it's really that new now. I think it came out in 1847 or something. But in the very beginning, people do radical, outrageous, totally experimental things. And then it becomes established and familiar and mundane, and people stop being so daring.
Also, there's an established way of doing it.
Yeah, this is how you take pictures. And then the cameras, of course, now are totally automatic, so you just point them and press a button and you don't even think about it. Which leads to another kind of photography, and you know, the sort of the opposite end of the Ansel Adams spectrum. But it's an amazing thing. I just read about a new video camera that Casio just came out with that can shoot 1,200 frames per second of
wow.
video. It can only shoot 1 second at that speed, but it's only a $900 camera. Which, you know, up until now, if you wanted to shoot 1,200 frames per second, you needed a little laboratory setup. Mm. And it'll shoot full high definition at 60 frames per second, which means that it captures motion in a manner that's completely different from what we're accustomed to in movie theaters.
So in movie theaters, what's the...
It's 24.
24
frames per second.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That speed was chosen because that's what's considered to be the flicker fusion speed. If the light flashes on and off 24 times per second or faster, yeah. then you don't theoretically see that it's flashing.
Mm.
Now, in fact, the flicker fusion rate isn't the same rate as the motion fusion rate. When we perceive motion, The image needs to be, in effect, for most kinds of motion other than extremely fast things, it needs to be updated more like 50 or 60 times per second for us to see no stepping between positions. And you see that in the movies, and the camera pans a little bit. You see the scenery going by, and it goes in jerks, and it looks really kind of awful, and so they avoid panning. Mm. They only do it very slowly. Or if there's something moving that the camera is tracking, and you look at the background, it's bad, but the thing that's being tracked is clear. At 60 frames per second, it engages your autonomic nervous system, and you perceive real motion. Mm. And that means that the directors of movies that are being shot at 60 frames per second will have to be very mindful of the semicircular canals, because if you're looking out the windshield of a car and it's driving on a windy road, you'll get car sick watching it.
Huh.
Audiences will be very uncomfortable. And that's something we're not yet accustomed to. We'll probably learn how to deal with that in the theater, within the next few years as movies begin to appear at high frame rates.
That's interesting, because when you just hear high definition film or mm-hmm. TV, all you think about it is it's a clearer picture.
Right.
But you don't realize that there are all these subtler differences.
Well, it's another dimension.
Yeah.
But I guess when we think of photography, we don't think of film, which is sort of interesting. And of course, nowadays, film is becoming video, and photography is becoming digital.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't much difference between a digital movie camera and a digital still camera. There are differences, obviously. One optimized for one type of shooting or another will be different, but most of the pocket cameras that people buy nowadays do both. And most of the video cameras that people buy also shoot stills.
So I have a question. Why is it that the quality, like when you see the old photographs of the great photographers, there's something kind of rich and soulful about these photographs that even the best digital photography doesn't seem to have? Is there some like technical reason why that's so?
Well, the most important reason is the photographer.
Mm.
If you gave Ansel Adams a Nikon D3, he would do very, very stunning, timeless, astonishing, marvelous pictures. If you gave him a 30 megapixel Hasselblad, digital Hasselblad, he would do even more marvelous pictures. Part of it, of course, has to do with the chemistry and the fact that the older pictures were produced using methods that when they evolved in the hands of a technician or a craftsman or an artist, resulted in a certain kind of accepted tonal range that seemed to be the best you could get using those materials. And with digital photography, the darkroom has been replaced by something vastly more creative and powerful and interesting, which is, of course, Photoshop or a dozen other programs that manipulate images. So nowadays, when you shoot with a digital still camera, unless you're still shooting on film, in which case you're not using a digital still camera, when you shoot with a digital still camera, you really are shooting with the assumption that the image will be dealt with in the dark room of software.
Mm.
And that opens up a lot of possibilities, but it also, in a strange way, it brings all of these image manipulation tools so close to hand that just tweaking the exposure the way we used to do in the darkroom with chemicals, by running the enlarger a little longer and dodging and burning in and so forth manually, and playing with the actual light of the enlarger, with digital photography, you have those tools right at your hand, but you also have just as accessibly 100 other tools that do things that didn't used to be within the realm of photography. So there's this question of how much image manipulation in Photoshop is sort of fair or real or natural, or, you know, if you take a picture and your skills as a camera operator get you something that's underexposed. If it's not badly underexposed, in Photoshop you can recalculate the exposure and make it look like it's properly exposed without necessarily damaging the image in any way. And so then that raises other questions. Are you cheating? Mm. Or is that okay? Is that just part of the photographic medium?
Today, yeah. Wait, I guess it's the same thing with recording, because now when a singer records a song in a studio, they can, if she's off, she or he is off pitch, they can correct that.
Yep. And they used to have to re-record it and then maybe splice in that one note. Mm-hmm. That was tricky, required high level mm-hmm. of engineering skills. Now there's software where you can just literally go in with the mouse and drag the pitch of that note up a little bit and make it right on.
Yeah, but even with all of that you just said, about Ansel Adams, if he had a digital camera, would do beautiful photographs. Wouldn't there still be a difference in, I don't know, to me there still is a difference in something, I don't know whether it's has to do with the grain of the photo or with the, I'm not sure what is, but whenever I've seen a digital photo and compared it with the older, especially large format camera photos, obviously, there's something missing to me in the digital.
I really do think it's just a matter of technique. There are differences, unquestionably, but if you go back in time to a pure film environment and talk to professional fine art photographers, you'll hear endless discussions about the differences between this developer and this film and that film and this approach to processing and that approach to processing. And all of those things make distinctions between images that are very comparable to what you're describing. Now, the odds of seeing a digital photograph that was taken with the same sensibilities and produced with the same aims as an Ansel Adams are very slim. You know, most people are not trying to recreate quite the same thing. Mm-hmm. But also, of course, you know, he was shooting on very large format films. Yeah. So unless you go to some extremes, digitally, it's not, you can't really recreate a 5x7 view camera kind of image. I mean, there's an almost infinite amount of detail in a negative that size.
I mean, I think it's two different things. These photographs created in a lab in that way, it's a different, it's not a digital photograph produced in 2008. And there's probably some very, and I think you're tuning into a very fine distinction that there's a very fine distinction between the quality of a digital image and a film image that's not unlike the difference between an analog recording and a digital recording. And is that what they call it, analog?
Yeah.
That it's hard to, like, I mean, there's a point at which I don't think you can just,
right.
It depends on prejudice in some ways.
That's really what I mean. Yeah, there's a point where no one can tell the difference. And there are, you know.
But they're general. If you see a grossly one that's this way and a grossly one that way,
you know, 99%
you can't miss that there's a difference between the two.
Right.
But when you come to the fine level that, say, a master artist would be working, I think you wouldn't care anymore. Because he would be moving you so deeply with the richness of the image.
And anybody if you look at the fine art photography done with digital cameras, you can't tell whether it was done with a digital camera or not. Mm. You have no way of knowing if he shoots on film or not. And it's like saying if it's done on, some kind of digital printer, then it has a fundamental difference from emulsion, from film and paper, film emulsion on paper, and that's quite true. It's a different kind of inkjet.
Maybe that's what I think that's what my question is related to, like the print on paper. Because actually, come to think, like when I've seen people's digital photographs on a computer screen, there can be that richness, and the light that's coming through. There's just, and then I'll say, oh, can I have a print of that?
Yes.
And then I'm not satisfied with the print of it because it doesn't have the...
Because a couple hundred dollars worth of amateur equipment in the hands of amateurs doesn't produce the same thing as thousands of dollars worth of equipment in the hands of experts and master artists. There are people who specialize in black and white digital photography, and they use modified Epson printers with 4 or even 8 shades of gray, and they produce prints that are indistinguishable from film prints. They're absolutely wonderful. They have a richness of tone in the black and white domain that's stunning. I mean, it stops you cold.
But to be an amateur photographer, is it impossible then to get that quality? I mean, do you need thousands of dollars of equipment to get something?
No, you just need to know more about the medium. Mm. You want to avoid overexposing things at all cost, because when digital images are overexposed, they burn out in a way that looks different from when the emulsion is burned out on the on the negative, and it's instantly recognizable as video-like. And but the range of possibilities for digital photography, even without what you might call special effects, I think is greater than it was with film. And then it's just a question of really what image you're trying to produce and why.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.